Parshas Noach. This is actually dedicated in memory of an old friend's father. Actually, you met his grandson. Tonight is the yahrzeit of, or tomorrow, of Shimon Gedalia ben Pinchas Menachem, a certain Mr. Harris who lived in Boca Raton. He was a very special person, but above all things, he was very into Achdus, Achdutam, bringing people together. Did a lot of chesed. His grandson was the one who gave out the candies on Simchas Torah, Ethan. So I guess he's following in his grandfather's footsteps. I think he was a candyman of sorts also, but I might be wrong about that. So we're going to dedicate this year in his memory. Nobody asked me to. I just happened to notice his yahrzeit. I'll tell you a powerful story. You know, goodbyes are very often taken for granted. And sometimes, when you're saying goodbye, you appreciate it. Sometimes you don't. You know, my cousin, Danny Hillman, whose son Benji was killed in the Second Lebanon War, came here once to speak. He was a few times. Spoke to the guys before Yom HaZikaron, before Memorial Day, a few years ago. And he opened up the floor to questions and basically said, there isn't a question that you can ask that I haven't been asked. And I really don't mind. You don't get a chance to meet someone like that often. I think I shared this with you once. And so guys started asking questions. And one of the questions that somebody asked him was, if you had 60 seconds with your son, what would you say to him? And he didn't hesitate. He said, I would say, I love you, I love you, I love you. What else would you say? He said that the last time he saw his son, he had no clue that it was the last time he was seeing his son. The war, you know, sort of had started. They had just gotten married. They were moving into their apartment. And he stopped by just to bring them some innocuous item that he thought they could use. And he brought by, and they were busy and whatever. And so he, you know, kind of left the door and said bye, and that was it. He had no idea that he would never see his son again. If he had that goodbye for a moment. And then there are times where you say goodbye and you really get it. You just don't know. I remember when in the middle of Tzuk Eitan, in the middle of the war in Gaza, and our son, the older son, was heading back to Gaza. I didn't know exactly what he was doing there because he's in an intelligence, whatever Modin said, like, it doesn't matter. He's in the unit. And he comes out in his uniform, and it's Sunday morning, and I had to say goodbye to him. I was actually jamming on the guitar, and he sat down and started jamming with me, and my wife was like blown away. So she ran inside and got the camera and started filming us. I didn't realize she was filming us. And I remember thinking, and you could see it on my face, like, is this really goodbye? You don't want to go there. And I saw a story during Tzuk Eitan that really got me. It's about a boy named Avi. I think that's not his real name, but it doesn't really matter. He was in Gdud. I don't know how much you guys know about sort of that war, but in the Second Lebanon War, not in the Azov War, in the Second Lebanon War, there was a period of time where troops were sort of massed in the north on the border, but they weren't going in yet. The Air Force was pounding Hezbollah positions. They hadn't decided if they were going to send in ground troops. They were sending in some ground troops. He had these whole units of reserve duty soldiers that were sort of called up. They were on the line. They were on the border with Lebanon. They had all their gear. And every day they thought they were going in, and they didn't. So it got to be very intense. They thought they were going in. They weren't going in. In a certain way, that's actually very difficult. And one day the battalion commander called them all together, and he said, look, you have 24 hours. Leave. We've been told that we're going in, you know, tomorrow morning or whatever. And you have 24 hours. You can go home, see your loved ones, you know, have a chance to see them because we don't know what's going to be and we're going to be doing some very difficult things. And obviously you can't tell anybody you're going tomorrow morning, but everybody figured it out. So he went home for 24 hours and he got to see his family and his parents, whatever. And the next morning he had to head back, you know, up to the border. And his father said, you know what, I'm going to drive you. He's like, no, you don't have to drive me. It's a far drive. He goes, no, I want to drive you. Okay. So they get in the car, and he drives him. It's like a 3-hour drive. And he said his father was uncharacteristically silent. And he realized that his father just didn't want to talk because he was afraid he would lose it. And they had this kind of unwritten kind of dialogue. They weren't going to have a dialogue. So it was a very quiet car ride. Been in car rides like that. And they got to this parking lot where they were supposed to meet all the way up north near the border. And the bus was going to take the men, you know, to where their encampment was. And finally the father gives his sons a hug. And he gives him a bracha, you know. And he gives him a really long hug. And he's trying not to lose it. But you can't really not lose it in a moment like that. But you can't lose it either because your sons... So they had this really heartfelt goodbye. And then his father patted him on the back, gave him a kiss on the forehead, got into his car and drove off. Just couldn't handle it. And the guy with a heavy heart is walking towards the staging ground. And he passes the car and he sees this young woman, pregnant, with her head covered, who's weeping hysterically. And he realizes she must have just said goodbye to her husband. And then he walks a little further and he sees another fellow. And this fellow's giving a long hug to his son. And he looks around the parking lot and he sees that the whole parking lot is just full of goodbyes. And in one moment, you think you're totally alone. And the next moment, he writes, you realize you're part of something much bigger. And that image stuck in my head for a long time. You know? All over this country, every Sunday morning, there are goodbyes. And sometimes they're intense and sometimes they're not. Which brings us to this week's parsha. This week's parsha is the ultimate goodbye. Right? Noach gets in the ark. He gets in the teva. And, you know, it's not like in modern times you get to sit by the window. There's no window. There's actually machlokas, this debate. It says, Sohar ta'aselcha. One of the things Hashem tells Noach to put into the ark is it's Sohar. Anybody know what it's Sohar is? Rashi gives two possibilities. You want to say? So one possibility, it's a window. What's the other possibility? An Evan Yikara, some sort of a jewel that produced light. It's not clear exactly how that worked, but that's what Rashi believes it was. Some sort of a chandelier. Maybe they lit candles and the jewel spread the light around. They actually had devices like this a long time ago. What's the fundamental difference between a window and a chandelier? The window brings light from the outside. The chandelier is light just from the inside. And I once heard a shiur from Rav Riska in the name of Soloveitchik who suggested that the Or Sameach, maybe the fundamental difference was whether Noach deserved to be able to look out the window. Because Noach gets into the ark and he's all alone. Takes his family with him, that's it. Nobody goes with him. And there must be this moment. Because the world doesn't get it, but he gets it. There's something scary about being a prophet, about really knowing a truth, a reality that no one knows. I read a book once about Zev Jabotinsky. If you know a little bit about Jabotinsky, he was Menachem Begin's mentor. And he was in Poland in the years before the big war, before World War II, before the Holocaust. And he went from community to community and he said to them, you don't see what's coming. There's a storm coming. Hitler is not going to stop with Poland. He's not going to stop with Czechoslovakia. He's going to take over. Everything that you know is going to disappear. It's time to come home. And he was desperate and he was in pain and he saw what was coming. And nobody listened to him. After the war, people called him the Navi. They called him the prophet because he saw what was coming. It's a very lonely life. Noach gets onto the ark, onto the Teva. And there must be a moment where they pull the door shut. And he takes one last look. And he knows that the world as he knows it is going to disappear. It will never be the same. You know? And he says goodbye. Powerful. Sometimes you experience that in life. And it raises a whole host of questions. First of all, why exactly did Kadosh Baruch Hu have to destroy the whole world? Well, Hashem destroyed the world because it was filled with Hamas. Batim Leretz Hamas, right? The land was filled with, what is Hamas? Pardon? No, not chaos, close, violence. Most posts would say it was violence. Related to Gezel. Violence. I'll leave you to think about the fact that the word for Hamas in the Torah is violence, but we'll put that another time. So the world is filled with violence, so Hashem has to destroy the world. Now let me ask you a question. Hashem creates a world. He knows it's going to be filled with violence. And therefore he knows that a world that's filled with violence, what's the purpose of having a world filled with violence? Whatever purpose you ascribe to humanity, it's certainly not to hurt each other and to fill the world with darkness. So if the world's going to be filled with violence, then the world has to be destroyed. But we're talking about Hashem. Hashem is the Ein Sof. Hashem knows that the world's going to fill with violence. So Hashem creates a world in order to destroy it. It makes no sense. Why would Hashem create a world in order to destroy it? Maybe you have to appreciate what doesn't work. It's interesting that in between Breishit, which is about the foundation, the creation, and Lech Lecha, which is the beginning of our journey as a Jewish people, there are these experiences that don't work. We need to see what doesn't work. Hashem puts Adam and Chava, or Adam, in Gan Eden. He says, don't eat from the tree. Does Hashem know he's going to eat from the tree? Of course he does. What's going to happen when he eats from the tree? He's going to get kicked out of Gan Eden. So Hashem knows that Adam's going to get kicked out of Gan Eden. So Hashem puts Adam in Gan Eden in order to kick him out. Hashem creates two brothers. He doesn't even have to say don't kill. It's pretty obvious. One of them kills the other. We keep having these experiences of what is not. And before we get into what I really want to talk about, I think it's worth thinking about that for a minute. You know, you go through life sometimes and you feel like you failed. You messed up. You know? Chorev Zman is not this upward climb. It's a roller coaster. You have your up days and your down days. You learn as much from the ups as you do from the downs. And you learn as much from the downs as you do from the up. You know? Sometimes you don't succeed. That lack of success, that failure, that's an awesome moment. That's the child who's learning to walk and falls. If you didn't learn from falling, you would never learn to walk. So we need to see what the world is not supposed to be before we see what the world is. By the way, this is the paradigm for most of what you're going to study. If you think about it, anytime we get into serious discussions, at least here at Oraita, we usually start with what something isn't. Right? Before you can talk about what Hashem is, you have to talk about what God isn't. Right? Like Hashem is not God. I'm sure Rabbi Aaron's had that discussion with you. No? Yes? Maybe? Okay, so then I don't have to. Great. Okay? We talked about tefillah. And we said before we talk about what tefillah is, we have to talk about what it's not. It's not prayer. Jewish tefillah is not prayer. So this is not the world, and this is not the way the world is meant to be. And every time I see the world that was destroyed by the flood, and I see it around me, I need to know that that's not what the world is supposed to be. You know, I saw an article in the papers. Forget his first name, which is good. We should forget these people's first names. But al-Baghdadi, who I'm sure you've heard of, he was the mastermind of ISIS. So he was killed by a U.S. commando team, Baruch Hashem, right? What was the headline in the Jerusalem Post, right? Terrorist mastermind killed by U.S. commando team, right? Okay. What was the headline in the Washington Post? Really interesting. Anybody see this? I know. Everybody's big on Washington. Let me give you an awakening, okay? Right? In the Washington Post, it said, Bashar, what's his first name? Bashar, anybody know? Pardon? Abu Bakr. Okay, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, poor guy. Must have had a cruel mother. Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, right, dies at age 48. That was the headline. Unbelievable. So people started Twittering. And they changed it. They said, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was the chief of ISIS, and a poet, and a radical, you know, and it says all these different things. It doesn't say he's a Muslim fundamentalist terrorist. So people started Twittering. You know, Adolf Hitler, an artist who was into landfill, died at age 49 in Berlin. Like, there's something missing from this story. You know? And it took them a whole day to get what was missing. You know? He's a terrorist! He's a Muslim fundamentalist. I'm not... If you can't see evil for evil, you can't fight evil. If you don't see a world that isn't supposed to be, you can't create the world that is. If I don't see, before I get to Lech Lecha, before I understand what the journey is, I have to understand what the journey is not. The journey is not a world full of Hamas. And if I don't get that, then I'll never be able to build a world full of peace. Now, by the way, this is not just, you know, international. This is personal. Before I build the world around me, the world according to whoever, Josh Hall or Zach Bernstein or J.J. Blinken, whoever it is, before I can build the world that I'm meant to build, I have to be sure that I know the world that I'm not supposed to build. You know? And it's from the big to the little. You know? If in the world around me, I'm all psyched because I'm going out to meet some friends and we're having a good time, but maybe my roommate or the guy next door is a little bummed because he doesn't have anybody to go with, that's not how the world is supposed to be. That's a world of Hamas. That's not the way the world is supposed to be. You can't build your world if the world around you isn't what it's supposed to be. You know? If you come in late at night and you make a noise, and I'm purposely picking sort of details, you know, there's no headline. You know, it won't say in the headlines, you know, Yonah Bergstein came back from the room tonight, made a little noise, two people were woken up, it was 45 degrees in the morning. Like, that doesn't make the news. It's just the detail. But it's not the world as we created, right? So that's the first message of Noach. Hashem is telling us, know what the world is not supposed to be. And understanding what that means, Vatimalei Aretz Chamas, is an interesting question. But now it gets interesting. Because if you look at the pasuk, like if I was an environmentalist, this would be my parsha. Like if I was creating sort of, you know, the green convention, you know, vegans unite, this would be the parsha. You know? This would be what we do. Except there's an interesting detail here. So Hashem has to destroy the world. Why does Hashem destroy the world? Because people are killing each other, right? Tell me what's wrong with this pasuk. You ready? Tell me what's wrong with this verse. Okay? Vayomer Hashem. Well, Vayinachem Hashem ki asa et ha'adam ba'aretz v'yitatzev el libo. Hashem relented, let's say, from having made the world, and Hashem was sad. Right? Now, that's a difficult line to understand. We're not going to go there right now, but we've talked about Simcha before. Right? What is Simcha? Simcha is all about... Didn't we talk about this? We definitely talked about this. Simcha is all about purpose. So, if Etzev is the opposite of Simcha, what does Etzev mean? Sadness? When there's no purpose. Well, if you have a world where people are killing each other, people are violent, people hate each other, then there's no purpose to the world. And the lave is the thought of Hashem. That's one way of understanding it. Not that that means we understand what that means. There's no purpose. So, Vayomer Hashem, Emchet Adam Asher Barati. I'm going to erase, I'm going to destroy humanity that I created. Me'al Pnei Adama, from the entire world. Me'adam Ad Behima. Ad Remes Ve'ad Ofa Shamayim. Every animal, every creature, every bird, everything, I'm going to wipe them all out. Ki nichamti ki asitim, because I relent having made them. Ask me an obvious question. Yes.
I had a question. I don't know if it's obvious.
Okay. Yeah. Somebody. Yeah. Zeb. What the animals do? Why do you, I love when they do that? Why do you have to destroy the animals? Why do you have to destroy? You know. I mean, you've got this image of a Kadosh Baruch Hu and his malachim, and they're out there killing everybody. And he's like, no, get that lizard. That lizard, get it. What does that have to do with destroying the world? Why does the Torah tell me we have to destroy every last animal? You want to say something?
I have a different question.
Mm-hmm.
How could God regret creating something that he knew?
Excellent question. How could Hashem regret something Hashem did if what Hashem does is perfect? Excellent question. Yeah?
So... he destroyed all the animals, but just like Noah and his family were on the table, there were also like a pair of
people. So one second. So the animals are all going to be destroyed, except for two of each species. Hang on a second. Except for two of each species. Hashem says to him, destroy all the animals, except I want to save the animals. So here's what you're going to do. You're going to collect two of each animals in the world. Pshat in the pasuk. Anybody know how long it takes Noah to do this? Takes him a year. That's pretty unbelievable. Takes him a year. By the way, imagine Noach's neighbors. Okay? Does anybody know how long it takes? How long does it take Noah to build the ark, by the way? 100 years. Which is a little crazy. I mean, as big as the ark was, shouldn't take 100 years. But okay, he's a perfectionist, fine. You know? So you got to picture this scene. You know, Noah's out in front, and he's building. And one of the neighbors says, "Hey, Noah, hey, what you building there?" "Building an ark." "Why are you building an ark?" "Gonna be a flood." "Well, what do you mean it's gonna be a flood?" "Oh, it's gonna rain. You're all gonna die." So, you know, I don't know, maybe the first day, I mean, maybe Noah was a holy person. Noah was a holy person, so the first day people get nervous. Week goes by, month goes by, 2 months go by, years go by. I gotta figure by the end of the first decade, he's the joke of the neighborhood. You know? "Noah's building the ark! Whoa!" You know? What happens in year 50? You know? "That guy's been building that ark since I was 9 years old." And then one day, you know, next door neighbor's sitting and have a cup of coffee. It's the morning, he's got to go to work. And all of a sudden he hears this crazy sound. You know, and he looks out the window and there's two elephants coming into the yard. And the guy starts bringing elephants and giraffes and hippopotamuses. He's cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. And you know, God tells me. And they go over to Noah and they say, "Why are you bringing elephants? Why are you bringing elephants into the yard? Do you know what kind of a mess an elephant leaves in the yard? Who's going to pay for cleaning up my front? Like, this is crazy." Noah has no problem. Whatever Kosh Baruch Hu tells him to do, he does. He's the ultimate believer. And he's got to put two of these, each of these, on the ark. Why? So that he can save the animals. And you can imagine the rabbis have a field day with this. You know, what about lizards? Were birds in the ark? Well, the birds could just hang out outside. Did they come in? Did the fish come in? The fish were saved. Why weren't the fish destroyed? We could have that discussion some other time. So Hashem says, "I'm going to destroy the whole world, and I have to destroy all the animals. But you're going to create a zoo. This is the biggest zoo in the world. It's a floating zoo. And you're going to live in the zoo, by the way." Now, Chazal, you know, they figured Noah wasn't stupid. And I'm not getting into the Kabbalistic overtones to this. That's for some other time. But there were different floors. So the people lived on the top floor. And the animals lived on the middle floor. Why, by the way, did the animals not live on the top floor? Because of what happened on the bottom floor. What's on the bottom floor? It's the fashmutz from all the animals. I guess they drilled holes in the middle floor and they did all their fashmutz and then you wash the thing and it went down to the bottom. So they had a floating fertilizer system, right? I mean, could you imagine? I worked in a refit. I worked in a dairy one summer on a kibbutz. And it took me a few days to get used to it. After that, I really liked it. There's a rich, rich, deep smell to fertilizer. To this day, when we're driving late at night, and the fields with the manure and the smell comes in, I love that smell. It's a rich smell. It's b'niyat ha'aretz. It's building the land. It's agriculture. My kids think I'm out of my mind, right? By the fourth day, I was like into the smell. So you start working and you stop noticing it. You know, but can you imagine, you come back at the end of the day, you walk into your kibbutz room, and you smell, you know, verstunken, and your roommates won't let you in the room. Right? That's... So can you imagine Noach and his children? I mean, they lived with this.
So
do we. So... Now you know why that happened, Parshas Noach. It's all a message, people. It is. Right? It's a... I guess Matim Alei Aretz Chamas can sometimes take on a different meaning. I understand that. Right? So I don't understand. Why does Hashem need to destroy the animals? And if Hashem needs to destroy the animals, why is Noah being tasked with saving the animals? And why can't God save the... What is that all about? Yeah.
So my question is that the pair of animals, like of each kind of animal that you took, were like better than all the other animals? Just like Noah was more of like a tzaddik than all the people in the world, and then they wanted...
Why did he pick these two animals?
Yeah.
Oh, that's an interesting question. I know of no source that suggests that there were any criteria to pick the animals. That doesn't mean there isn't such a source. Maybe they were holy animals, I don't know. My guess is it's like the hunter who goes hunting. He picks the animal that he finds. You know? You picked your first two elephants. I don't know. It's a good question, though. Were they looking for the strongest animals? That's an interesting question. I don't know. Yeah?
So then why not save all animals? If you're going to take two random animals, then they're going to multiply and
multiply. Right. Why kill them all to save? You're catching this pattern. I'm destroying the world in order to rebuild it. By the way, why does Noah get saved? So that the human civilization can survive. But Hashem is destroying human civilization. So if Hashem really wants human civilization to survive, don't destroy him. And if you say that this civilization needs to be destroyed, then wipe them all out, and the Kosh Baruch Hu will create another one. Well, how much best could he be if the whole world sank into violence when he was there? Why not create someone who wouldn't let it fall into violence? It's the same question, it's just a different level. Same question. Okay? Somebody here wanted to say no? Okay. So let's think about this, right? What's with the animals? So I want to show you something interesting. Okay? This is really interesting. What I'm about to share with you, I don't know that this is pshat. It's just something I noticed once. You know, we have an easy time catching the big stories. The little details sometimes elude us. At the end of Parashat Bereishit in Parakeh, there is a list of generations. Okay? It's a list of generations. If you heard the laning of Bereishit on Shabbat, so you know what I'm talking about. It's like the parak that everybody tunes out. And basically, right, it lists every generation. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says, how many generations were there from Adam until Noah?
Ten.
Ten is a very significant number. How many generations were there from Noah until Avraham?
Ten.
Okay. So the Torah list, this is not some midrashic, rabbinic legend. This is pshat in the Torah. You can see the Torah list is, the first one was Adam. And then he has a son, because obviously Cain and Hevel was a mess. But he has a son named Shait. Kishatli Elohim Zera Acher Tachat Cain Asher Harado Tachat Hevel Asher Harado Cain. Right? So if you look, each of these generations, there's a description. And the description goes as follows, right? Vayichi Adam Shloshim U'me'at Shana. Avram lived 130 years. Vayolad B'dmuto K'tzalmo, and he has a child. Vayikra et Shmo Shait, and he's called Shait. Vayu Yemei Adam Achreo Lido et Shait. Now, how long did Adam live after Shait was born? Shmona Me'ot Shana. He lived 800 years. Vayolad Banim U'Banot. So let's get this straight. Adam lives 130 years, he has Shait. He lives 800 years after Shait is born. Right? So how old is Adam when he dies?
930.
And that's exactly what the Pasuk says. Right? Vayu kol yimei Adam asher chai, and all the days of Adam's life, 930 years and he dies. Obvious question is, no, much more obvious question than that.
How?
No, not how, not why not.
What?
Yeah, why do I need the pasuk to tell me that Adam lives to be 930? If Shait is born when Avram is 130, when Adam is 130, and then after Adam is 130, lives 800 years, he's 930 years old when he dies. Torah doesn't waste words. Gets better. That's Adam. Let's see what happens with Shait. Vayichi Shait. Shait lives 105 years and he gives birth. I know he doesn't give birth, but we'll just use that terminology. He has a son, right? Called Enosh. So he's 105 when Enosh is born. He lives another 807 years. Do the math. How old is he when he dies? 912. I get this same superfluous pasuk. And if you look at the 10 generations, with a couple of additions, you know, Chanoch, Vaitale Chanoch et Elokim, Noach, there's a little description, but other than that, that's the basic pattern. Here's how old he was when his son was born. Here's how many years he lived after his son was born. And here's the total years of his life. And the total years of his life I don't need. So that's a question. But it gets better. Because if you look in Parsha Noach, in this week's Parsha, you see the same thing. You see in Perek Yud Aleph, by the way, just an aside, we're not going to get into this, but if you want to do a fascinating project, right, there's a lot that we can learn from these years. For example, if Adam is 130 when Shet is born, and Shet is 105 when Enosh is born, let me say that again. If Adam is 130 when Shet is born, and then Shet is 105 when Enosh is born, how old is Adam when Enosh is born? 235. Okay? And you can do that with all the generations, including the generation that I'm about to describe in the time of Noah. And you can actually see who was alive when. And you'll notice something interesting. You'll notice, you can do this. This is worth doing. You take a piece of paper, write it down, you'll see. You'll see that when Avram was born, Noah was still alive. How old was Avraham when Noah died? You can actually figure out from these psukim. Anybody know? How old, let me ask that question again. How old was Avraham when Noah died? Pardon? He was 58 years old. What's the gematria of Noah? 58. Think about that. Think about that. It's not an accident. There's a lot of things that we can learn from this book, and we're not going to get into that. It's just one example. But this one gets me. Yes, Addison.
Can we say that like the years were different? Like when Noah lived and when Abram lived? It wasn't possible that someone could live to 800.
No. You're mixing up a different question, if I understand your question correctly. How could a person live to be 930 years old? That's what you mean. Right. The Mefarshim don't say that the years were different. The Pasuk says, Lo yadon ruchi ba'adam b'shagam hu basar. I can no longer tolerate man. After the flood, Hashem says, people living too long, right? It's like, why not give, you know, they used to have this concept in some yeshivas called No Torah Tuesday. They figured they would give guys a break Tuesday night, everybody had Tuesday night off, and they'd go out, and that way Thursday night they'd have a mishmar. I never understood that, you know, like, and we never had that in Gush, so we've never had No Torah Tuesday. You know, we have Torah every day, all day. You know, you're just supposed to do Torah, right? But one of the reasons for that is if you give people too much time, they get into nonsense. When you're busy, you don't do shtiyot. So Hashem says, if you have too much time in your hands, you can do nonsense. So He limits the amount of years that they live. He doesn't change the quality of the years. By the way, the Ramban. One of your crazy men, who's really into like healthy eating, natural? Anybody here? No? Yes? Okay. So this is your Ramban. The Ramban says, now understand, I have a hard time with this, but this is the Ramban. This is not like, you know, the Sachat Shavar. I mean, this is the Ramban, right? The Ramban says the reason that they used to live to 800, 900 years old is because they lived a much more healthy life. They slept well, they had no pollution. They tilled the soil, like they just lived a healthier life. You live a healthier life, you live longer. Which is an interesting question, you know, but that's for another time. So getting back to our point, now we gotta finish. Now we get to Perek Yud Aleph. Listen to this, Perek Yud Aleph, okay? Perek Yud Aleph does the same thing, right? It lists the generations. The 10 generations from Noach until Avram. Vayechi Shem. Eilat toldot Shem. Shem ben me'at shana. Vayoled et Arpachshad. Same pattern, right? Shem is 100 years old. He gives birth to Arpachshad. Shnatayim achar amabu. Okay. Vayichi Shem. Acharei lidor Arpachshad. 500 shana vayoled banim vono. He's 100 when he gives birth to Arpachshad, Shem. He dies 500 years after he gives birth to Arpachshad. How old is he when he dies? Well, come on. He's 100 when he gives birth to Arpachshad. 500 years later, he's 600 years old. Okay, Baruch Hashem. That's good, by the way. If you learn a lot of Torah, it makes you dumb in other subjects. It's a good sign. Okay, fine. So he's 600 years old. And then it stops. It doesn't tell me that he lived a total of 600 years. Then it says, V'Arpachshad. Listen to this. Chai Chamech V'Shloshim Shana. He lived 35 years. V'Yolad Et Shelach. He was 35 when he gave birth to Shelah. Then he lived another 400 years. It's missing that third pasuk. It's missing the Torah. What's fascinating about this, by the way, is if you didn't see Perek Hay, there is no way that you would have a question here. Because when you read Perek Yud Aleph reads as it's supposed to read. Why do you need that total pasuk? It's obvious how many years he lived. Because if he was 100 when the child was born, and he lived another 400 years, then he's 500 years old. Only because I look at Perek Hay, and I see that in the first generation, 10 generations, there is this pasuk describing the total years of his life, do I realize that in Perek Yud Aleph something has changed. So I would like to posit a theory. This is one of those ideas, I'm sure somebody noticed this. There must be, I just haven't been able to find it yet. Sure, it's there, I haven't looked that hard. So when you find it, anybody find this, somebody must talk about this, and if you come up with a good idea, let me know, I'd love to hear. But for now, since I haven't found anybody who says this, so I'd like to posit the following. Something changes. There are many indications in the Torah that life after the flood, as Addison alluded to, life after the flood is different from life before the flood. And this is the most obvious difference. We don't see a pasuk that delineates the totality of the years. There's no total. Maybe it's because before the flood, the focus is on the individual, on the totality of his life. It's all about what each individual does as an individual. In fact, in the period from Adam until Noah, with one exception, you do not find the concept of community. It's not what they do. Who is the only person who builds something resembling a community? Cain. Cain builds a city. Vayehi boneh ir. That's the only mention you find. It doesn't say people lived in the city. It doesn't say people worked together. There's no concept of people working together. Everybody's an individual. Now, there's a power to the individual. You know? One individual can change the world. I was standing there on the parade ground today, listening to this the commander. My son was telling me some stories about him afterwards. I didn't know this, and I was listening to him. He was from the Shayetet. Shayetet is the sea command of naval commanders. They're a sick bunch of guys that just... The stories about them are legendary, and the things that he did, and this guy was giving them their speech. And I was watching my son and the boys around him, and I noticed that they were paying rapt attention. Now, usually when a guy gives a speech, and there's 700 cadets, people aren't listening. They were listening. And I mentioned this to him, and he said, oh, we were listening, because if you knew who this guy was, you'd listen to what he said. He didn't speak for long. And he said to them, you, each of you, have made a decision. You've decided to take upon a responsibility that nobody tells you you have to take. And you've decided that you're willing to lead men to places that most people don't want to go. That's a power. And he says, it's impossible to know whether you will one day be tested so that you as an individual will be the reason that a battle gets won or lost, that a war gets won or lost. There's a power to an individual. That's before the flood. It doesn't work. Because when the power is of each individual, we get so stuck on ourselves, even if we get stuck on ourselves in a good way, we lose the community. If one guy shines, you know, you see this on the basketball court. Every once in a while in the NBA, you find some superstar who's so good, but his team never makes it because he doesn't know how to bring his team along. Just because you can make three-pointers and get to the basket and slam it in, if you don't know how to throw it around, if you don't know how to motivate your team, if you don't know how to spread it around, you'll never win the championship. It can't just be about the individual, right? So then we get to post-Noach. And in post-Noach, we find the opposite. What's the first story after the flood? Noach gets out, plants a vineyard, he's a mess. What's the first big story? Migdal Bava. What happens in Migdal Bava? We're going to finish, so I'm not going to belabor this. But you can look this up this Shabbos. What happens in Migdal Bava? Migdal Bava, the people get together and they want to build a tower. Na'aseh lanu shem. Let's make a name for ourselves. Right? They find Vayimtzu'u bik'a vayishvu sham. They live in a valley. They come off the mountains. They're building a tower for all sorts of different reasons. And they're working together. Vayikolam kolaretz. Safa achat. They all spoke the same language. Can you imagine What a world it would be if we all spoke the same language. What a magnificent idea. Whatever language it was. Imagine if you could walk through the shuk and you could talk to everybody in Hebrew. And imagine if you went to America and everybody spoke Hebrew. You spoke Hebrew. And by the way, it's not accidental that empires try to impose language. Because if we can all speak the same language, we can work together, that's unity, it's beautiful. That was probably the great, whatever chait they did, whatever terrible thing they did, at least they had unity. So what does God do? He doesn't like what they're doing. So what does he do? He splits them up. Everybody gets their own language, it becomes a mess. He undoes what seems to be the only good thing they have going for them. And I wonder if maybe, because just like the power of the individual can be dangerous, the power of community can be equally dangerous. You can get so lost in the klal, you forget that there's a value to the individual. This was, by the way, the mistake of communism. Communism believed that we have to, this was Marx, we have to create a society where the individual doesn't matter. We all contribute to the klal, to the whole. We put aside our differences. We become one nationality. We speak one language. So when the communist world began, that's what they did. They wanted to destroy the individual identities of all the nations. So they called it the USSR, the United Soviet Socialist Republic, or just all one republic. So it doesn't matter if you're Azerbaijan or Kaibaijan or Taibaijan or Khvestishbaijan. It doesn't matter. We're all going to speak Russian. It doesn't work. Judaism actually says something different. Judaism says that it's true that there's a value to the whole. There's also a value to the individual. That's why we have the concept of tribes. Every tribe brings something to the table. It's good that there are tribes, but it's also important that those tribes know how to work together. That's the balance from Parshat Bereishit to Parshat Noach, right? If Noach spends a year, right, what does Noach do? Something has to change. Something has to change because the world that Noach came from is all about individuals. And when it's all about individuals, you don't need each other. You know? I'm in the Beis Medrash, and I'm steiging, and I got it. So what's the difference if somebody next to me can't get it? You know? I get my piece of schnitzel. Life is good. What do I care if somebody else got a little less? You know? I'm eating schnitzel so that I can go back to the Beis Medrash and learn. And that's for God. And I get so focused on my own journey, I forget the fact that I'm supposed to be something part of something bigger. On the other hand, if I become so what does Noah have to do? Noah has to rediscover what it is to live as the part of society. And he starts with the animals. Animals naturally, instinctively know how to work together. Right? That's what they do. They work in teams, they work in packs, ants. But at the same time, animals represent a certain individual identity because they don't necessarily get along with each other. Can you imagine what it's like to have dogs and cats in an ark where you're closed in for over a year? You know, you've got tigers and horses. You've got lions and mice. And somehow you've got to figure out a way to make it work. You begin to discover that there's a value to the klal and to the individual. He goes to school. And it's the school to discover how society, how it's supposed to work. You know, there's an unbelievable, I'll finish with this, there's an unbelievable medrash. It's a medrash in Tehillim Rabbah in Perek Lamed Zayin. You can look it up. And it has young Avraham going to study in the yeshiva of Shem Ve'Aver. And in the medrash, Avraham asks Shem, also known as Malki Tzedek, how did you survive in that ark? I mean, you're in this dark ark for over a year, right? How did you survive? So he said, we did chesed. So Avram says, who did you do chesed for? So Malki Tzedek says, for the animals. We didn't sleep at night because we had to take care of all the animals. They learned to give. They learned to be part of something bigger. They learned to be part of society. But at the same time, they learned the value, not to forget, of the individual. And that's the secret of Parshas Noach. And I think that's what was going on with those Jews, those families in that parking lot. You know? It becomes a much bigger picture. It's not just about me. There's something powerful about this country. For whatever the reason, in this country, we are regularly given the experience of understanding that we're part of something much bigger. So I think it's appropriate, you know, that that we start Chorosh Man and Parshat Noach. You know, that this is our first week of learning. That we have a chance to think about how we fit. This is supposed to be a selfish year. It's a year where you don't get so involved in things outside of the yeshiva. You don't. It's not your big social actions year. You get to grow as a person because the person you become is the person that's going to have what to contribute. You just have to be really careful that as you take that journey, that it doesn't come completely at the expense of being part of a larger group. And that balance, which is not easy to find, that's what changes everything. So Hashem should bless you and us and all of us, B'shrat Hashem, to find that balance. I wish you an incredible, incredible Shabbos, you know. B'shrat Hashem, Parshat Noach. Next week we're going to get the Lech Lecha. Then we go deep.